if you're a writer, especially if you write fiction, it's hard not to feel possibly just a teeny bit envious of Jonathan Franzen. Back in 2001, you watched The Corrections become that very rare thing, this big, ambitious literary novel that becomes a big bestseller and wins the National Book Award. Now, in 2010, you watched the tremendous hullabaloo around his next book, Freedom, even more rapturous reviews, a Time magazine cover story headline, Great American Novelist, just published last week, technically, and already another big bestseller. You read the book thinking, maybe even hoping, that it can't be all that. Won't live up to the hype. Can't. But, you can't deny it. This really is a big, brilliantly observant, entertaining, moving, very, very fine piece of work. And so excellence defeats envy. Jonathan Franzen, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Nice to see you again.
And you. So how did it feel, for instance, when you heard that President Obama had taken an advanced copy to his vacation on Martha's Vineyard?
It felt exciting, actually, and I'm normally puzzled by people saying, aren't you excited, aren't you excited, as if that's a good thing. I think of excitement as mostly being a negative, but that afternoon when somebody passed the word along, I felt excited in a good way. And that had to do with my admiration of him and my feeling this is the first president, not only who's younger than me, but in my lifetime who I've really been excited about. So it was terrific.
Are you still excited about Barack Obama?
I am. I mean, I'm excited, but I'm also sad because his loss of traction in the last 6-8 months seems to confirm a feeling that increasing numbers of my friends have, that the country has become simply ungovernable.
And
that,
irredeemable?
I don't know about irredeemable, but let's save it first and then worry about redemption.
Certainly some of your characters would consider it irredeemable. And I can't remember, speaking of the President of the United States reading this novel, I can't remember the last time there was a novel that so many people of a certain kind, which is to say public radio listeners and New York Times readers, felt actually compelled to read and are reading in order to feel with it. And I'm wondering, how would you feel about this acclaim and this, the fact that it's on sort of the national syllabus suddenly, if it were being experienced by another novelist and not you?
It depends on the novelist, obviously. But if I like
a good novelist, a novelist you respected,
a good novelist that I respected, I think there would be a twinge of envy. That's where writers live. But I have been and continue to feel like a team player, and
in this most unteam playing of professions.
Well, yes and no. It's my conviction that my function as a writer is to serve a community of readers and writers, and I came to that conclusion in the mid-90s, partly out of a despair of reaching a large number of people with my work.
After you published a couple of novels.
A couple of novels, and they had done fine, but had made no discernible impact. I had found religion in a way and contented myself with the notion that there were some people who still care about this kind of thing, and that I grew out of that community of readers into a writer and had been given a certain gift, and my job was to give back. And in spite of sudden, unexpected evidence that the potential audience for a serious book is much larger than I'd ever guessed or hoped, I still am that team player.
Yeah. Well, good. The Corrections was, to summarize grotesquely, about a dysfunctional Midwestern family. Freedom is about a dysfunctional Midwestern family. Did you...
Can I interrupt and just quibble with the word dysfunctional?
Sure. Well, a problematic.
An interesting Midwestern family, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
A non-boring Midwestern family.
Definitely. Definitely. Although from the distance that most people would look at this family, the Berglunds, they wouldn't look so interesting or so dysfunctional most of the time, probably, from afar.
No, and indeed the novel opens with a long chapter from the point of view of the neighborhood they lived in, the gentrified neighborhood in St. Paul for 20 years.
Which I stupidly read in The New Yorker and just thought was a story. But then you told me that it was the beginning of your novel.
Indeed it was. but I'm happy you thought it was a story for as long as you were reading it. And I think their phrase for it is there was something always not quite right about the Berglunds. And at a certain point, even in that chapter, their highly charged emotional life spills out of the house and becomes the talk of the neighborhood. And that's really just the overture. So maybe from afar, you can keep a lot of stuff. You can keep the lid on a lot of stuff for a long time. But at a certain point, it spills out.
But given that after the corrections, you know, interesting, problematic Midwestern family, interesting, problematic Midwestern family, did you have any pause about sort of plowing what looked like the same territory?
All four of my novels have had families that in some way are Midwestern in them. It's the story I have to tell. And I've struggled against that limitation, that restriction of my total artistic freedom for a long time, and continue to struggle against it, and imagine that, you know, the next book will be about
people on Mars,
Bolivian revolutionaries or something, who have absolutely no family connections. But I keep the material that feels alive to me is the stuff that feels like a dream you might have about somebody very close to you, somebody, you know, in the dream, there's your mother, and she's been dead for 20 years, and there she is, still alive and still obviously very important to whatever part of you is dreaming. And that kind of charge I don't get from anything else. I don't get a charge from immersing myself in history. I don't get a charge even from immersing myself in science, although I love science and can never quite leave it alone. The family is just so charged with meaning for me that I can't get away from it. And I, you know, to speak quickly of my favorite North American writer, you look at Alice Munro, and she's writing the same story over and over again all her life, and her genius is to tell that story in a new way that you feel you've never read before, decade after decade. And there's something, it's actually akin to the spirit of the final spirit of this book, that you lose a lot by giving up that youthful sense of infinite possibility, but you gain a different kind of liberty to create within the constraint.
It's just difficult in terms of your characters and people, difficult for especially people born in the last 40 or 50 years, I think, to figure out how to make that transition from the end of limitless youthful possibility.
Yes, well, some people do it gracefully, and some people, like the Berglunds in this book, not so gracefully.
Two of the main characters, actually the two Berglunds, Patty and Walter, love War and Peace. And so I presume you take with your work Tolstoy's famous quote as your operating principle, that happy families are all alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way.
That's why I was quibbling with the word dysfunctional, and suggesting interesting as an alternative.
So somebody who has not yet read Freedom, what's your elevator version of who the Berglunds are?
I don't have an elevator version, and remarkably, this is the first time I've been asked to provide one. So let me think on my feet here.
That's because everyone is too reverential towards you, Jonathan.
I'm waiting to experience that in its extreme forms.
I can pretend.
Please don't. Elevator version. If you'd like to give me one,
well, who
I'm
are
all
they?
Ears.
Who are Patty and Walter?
Oh, okay. Yes, Patty's. Patty's an angry housewife, basically, who has come to the Midwest in flight from an East Coast that she perceived as corrupt and hostile to her. And she's come to the Midwest to make a new life in a more innocent-seeming place. And of course, as a novelist, I can't resist making her pay for for this.
She doesn't get to chill.
She doesn't get to chill because the stuff she's fleeing, in fact, she's carrying in her very genes. And so she manages to replicate many of the very family tensions that she was fleeing.
And Walter, whom she marries.
And Walter is the nicest guy in the world.
Apparently. Maybe actually.
I think actually the nicest guy in the world up to a point. He reminds me quite a bit of my dad, who is a very, very nice man, who also carried around a lot of anger that he rarely accessed. And for Walter, who is kind of a brainy guy, he was the kid at college who was organizing the symposium on the limits to growth in 1975, and he was writing the angry editorials in the college paper about people putting, you know, wasting peanut butter and sending it down the dish belt.
And he's now the guy who thinks NPR has gone conservative and deals only in trivialities.
He's had the experience of listening to Marketplace and feeling, why is growth always a good thing? Isn't growth almost synonymous with a cancer? So he has his own demons. And long about the time the White House changed hands in 2000, it begins to boil over. And of course, the frustrations of living with a person with unresolved issues like his wife feeds directly into that political rage and in some way displaces it or compensates for it.
Before we talk any further,
this is not a good elevator. It's got to be a tall.
It's a long
building.
Elevator ride.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd love you to read a little bit from Freedom to give the readers a sense of.
I'm taking the book across the little table.
Who Patty is? My producer would love you to read the paragraph on page 7.
Okay.
Beginning to Seth Paulson, and if you can just sort of set up where we are.
We're in the middle of that overture chapter, the first chapter. And let's see what's in this paragraph. The chapter is narrated from the point of view of some neighbors, the Paulsons, and we're beginning to get to know the Paulsons in this paragraph.
And we're in St. Paul.
We're in the 80s. The kind of, you know, the sort of Zinfandel and NPR and MPR 80s. So I'll start. To Seth Paulson, who talked about Patty a little too often for his wife's taste, the Berglunds were the super guilty sort of liberals who needed to forgive everybody so that their own good fortune could be forgiven, who lacked the courage of their privilege. One problem with Seth's theory was that the Berglunds weren't all that privileged. Their only known asset was their house, which they'd rebuilt with their own hands. Another problem, as Mary Paulson pointed out, was that Patty was no great progressive and certainly no feminist, staying home with her birthday calendar, baking those goddamn birthday cookies, and seemed altogether allergic to politics. If you mentioned an election or a candidate to her, you could see her struggling and failing to be her usual cheerful self, see her becoming agitated and doing too much nodding, too much yah-yahing. Mary, who was 10 years older than Patty and looked every year of it, had formerly been active with the SDS in Madison and was now very active in the craze for Beaujolais Nouveau. When Seth, at a dinner party, mentioned Patty for the third or fourth time, Mary went nouveau red in the face and declared that there was no larger consciousness, no solidarity, no political substance, no fungible structure, no true communitarianism in Patty Berglund's supposed neighborliness. It was all just regressive, housewifely bullshit. And frankly, in Mary's opinion, if you were to scratch below the nicey-nice surface, you might be surprised to find something rather hard and selfish and competitive and Reaganite in Patty. It was obvious that the only things that mattered to her were her children and her home, not her neighbors, not the poor, not her country, not her parents, not even her own husband.
That's Jonathan Franzen reading from his new novel, Freedom. In addition to being a lovely piece of writing, of course, it's among other things, captures perfectly, it seems to me, the difference between the oldest baby boomers, like mm-hmm, Mary mm-hmm. in that case, and the younger baby boomers, of whom you count as one.
Patty has been a student athlete, a standout student athlete. She was a basketball star until she hurt herself at the University of Minnesota, and was one of the very, very first people to benefit from Title IX. And she was, as she was not part of that first wave of feminists, and so she can see it's good. Yes, girl athletes should get the same funding that boy athletes do, but she will not make the connection, and that has to do in large part with her own very liberal parenting. That is the parenting she received. She had really a professional Democrat for a mother.
Who is one of the great unlikable caricatures, if you will, of an unlikable liberal in modern literature.
Oh, that's a little harsh. She's got her own cross to bear,
I guess. If Patty had had a serious career, would it all have worked out differently for her, better?
She thinks maybe it would have. Without a career, she becomes, one could say, overly focused on her children, particularly her son. And that's one of the things at the center of the book that I was trying to access from my own life and had found no direct way to write about. And one of the reasons it took so long to write this book was I had to develop this entire parallel world into which to pour my own experience. And part of that experience certainly was having a mom who was a little frustrated and perhaps a little overly focused on her own kids. And yet the particular form that took in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up had morphed into something different by the time you got to the 80s and the 90s. And the valence changed,
right,
usefully for my purposes, because I couldn't write about what was really going on with me in the 60s and 70s. It was just couldn't go there.
Is your mother still alive?
My mom's not. And
so there wasn't that to deal with?
No, there wasn't that to deal with. No, it's the sense of that she's still alive in some way. She's alive in me. I feel strains in my own character that correspond identically to strains in hers. And so there are times when I feel my mom is saying something and not I. And when the weather's rough and the plane is looking like it might go down, I think the thing I think is I'm going where she is.
You as you say, you write a lot about these relationships between parents and children and the Berglunds and their children, among others, and especially Patty Berglund and her son. You don't have children.
I do not have children.
Was that a challenge consciously of accessing how parents feel about their children in order to get at that kind of unconditionalism that presumably you haven't experienced?
I missed a key verb or two in that question. I'm sorry. My stomach was rumbling. I was paying attention to it.
Not having children. You're a great writer of fiction, and of course, empathy with people whom you are not is one of the skills one must have. But not ever having the experience of having children and the peculiar unconditional kind of love that is involved in from a parent to a children, was that a challenge for you to figure out? Has that been a challenge to figure out how parents actually feel about their children?
It was not the big challenge, certainly. It was not high on the list. Certainly, I put a lot of work into that too. I think the intense, almost morbid sense of identification I have with my own parents, particularly since they died, and the late dawning realization of what great parents they were, and in their absence, reading all the things they'd done and said in the context not of their being impossible parents who I had to get away from, but of their having actually been excellent parents, that was probably my primary conduit to the experience of having children was through my own parents, oddly.
Imagining how they felt about you.
But obviously my brothers have kids. Many of my best friends have kids. So I it's not – you don't have to go far to find a parent.
No, but like Walter's love or Walter's relationship and regard for his son seems, for all his niceness, kind of conditional and the least nice thing about him perhaps.
They have a very deep personality clash, and that is a challenge, I think. It's easy when your kids are more or less like you, but and often that happens, but often it doesn't work that way. And then it is a challenge to love them unconditionally anyway, even when they are mounting a direct reproach to much of what you stand for. And I think in the fullness of the book, things change.
Yes.
But when you catch a kid who's 16 and preternaturally self-possessed, in open rebellion and open defiance and open disavowal of everything you believe in, you know, people and novels don't get written about people behaving their best in perfect situations.
Well, and when your son starts reminding you of your best friend and lifelong rival, I want to talk about these two main adult men in Freedom, both of whom are about your age. One is this liberal do-gooder, Walter, working to save birds in the end. And you're a liberal do-gooder bird watcher. The other, Katz, is this celebrity artist who's ambivalent about his celebrity, like Jonathan Franzen. Are you more like Walter or more like Katz?
Do I have to choose?
Yes.
Okay.
You can say I'm equally like both of them.
I know. That seems like a weasel answer. Although I suppose not choosing would be the same answer. I think in the way I read a newspaper, I'm much more like Walter. And some of the, he has exaggerated versions of my own responses to much of what's going on in the world, particularly environmentally. But in terms of a depressive writerly nature, I totally identify with Katz, and he's, you know, they're both enough different that I was able to write them. If they were more like me, I couldn't do it.
Yep. No, I certainly felt elements of both and decided in the end that that having elements of both is what saved me from the tragedies of each, perhaps.
Good.
There was a piece in the New York Times last year saying all fiction, significant fiction writers of your generation, including you, are too ambivalent about depicting lusty sex. Seems to me, among other things, this book is an answer to that charge in your case.
I remember that piece. I didn't read it, but there was a bar chart on the cover of the Times Book Review, and I was very happy to find myself in the middle. You know, more sex than writers a little younger than me, not as hyper.
But no Roth or Mailer.
Right, exactly. Not quite the same.
But there's plenty of sex in this. There's a lot of hotness in this book.
The book had been delivered by the time that piece came out, so it certainly was not written in response to that reproach. It's, you know, there's a lot of sex in dreams, and there can be a lot of sex in dreams, and the endeavor over and over was to write a book that trafficked in the kind of deep archetypes and deep symbols and fraught situations that characterize dreams, but to do it in a way that's deliberate so that the dream actually was not susceptible to infinite interpretation, but seemed to, at the intuitive level, have a meaning. And you put yourself into that dream state to do the writing, and sex comes along. It's really as simple as that.
Especially when one of the major characters is a rock and roller.
Yes.
As opposed to a prudent Midwestern guy.
That's right. Fun contrasts were there to be had.
Now, what about birds? I know you've written about environmental catastrophes around the world, and I know you are a bird hobbyist. But in this book, Walter's involvement with saving a bird, to me, is depicted as a somewhat ridiculously quixotic exercise. Did you mean it to be that?
Let me say right here that I resisted. There's a bird on the cover of the American version. Someone made my day the other day by saying they hadn't noticed the bird because it's in such extreme close-up. But I resisted having that bird there because I thought, oh, my God, that's going to send the message environmental novel. And the last thing I feel like reading is a straightforward environmental novel because it's the news is bad. Great. Can't wait to read it. And we know what's right and we know what's wrong. Well, that sounds like a interestingly complex moral landscape.
one of the excellences of this book is that it does not permit easy default to political points of view, simple political points of view.
In the course of my developing interest in birds, I've become involved in bird conservation, and I've had an opportunity to meet a number of people doing various kinds of conservation work. And one of the striking things is how many of them work very closely with industry and are making these really hard calls, these adult decisions, that is to say, not doctrinally correct decisions about how much to compromise with the people who control the money. And
for instance, whether to let coal miners
whether to let the coal come out of a region in West Virginia before reclaiming it and setting it aside permanently, or whether to risk leaving the coal underground for somebody to go and rip out later. Partly, that's simply that's realism. If you do serious conservation, you're going to find yourself in these morally very fraught situations. And
if you're going to be effective,
right? Yeah. And Walter gets involved with a guy who's worth a couple hundred million dollars and who has a bee in his bonnet about this one little bird, the cerulean warbler, which in fact is in a lot of trouble.
Do house cats really kill a million songbirds a day, as you say in this book?
Minimum.
Really?
Minimum.
I felt bad about my two cats.
Cats should be indoors.
So Walter says, and I guess Jonathan Franzen says as well.
Yes, there are some substantial areas of overlap, particularly on the subject of keeping cats indoors.
Now, Cats, the rock star, finally begins to make peace with his celebrity, about which he's acutely ambivalent and self-destructive earlier in the book. Do you feel there was a big hoo-ha when your last novel came out about your ambivalence regarding celebrity? Do you feel as though you too have made some peace?
It calls to mind the great Flannery O'Connor line about the sorry fact being that fiction writers are not too distressed about the fact that there will always be poor people in the world, because fiction writers themselves feel poor, and it's not about literal poverty necessarily. It's about a poverty fundamental to mankind, is her phrase. And it is disorienting to not be poor, literally not be poor, for a fiction writer who has spent 40 years making do with little and feeling close to people on the edge. There were a couple of years of disorientation about that I could actually suddenly have a comfortable life. And I used to talk about it with my friend Dave Wallace that somehow the system in the United States has figured out a way to buy off precisely the people who are most likely to be effectively discontented.
That's
with
why
the system.
It's such a good system. This is David Foster Wallace, the late novelist.
That's right. So how to keep the distress levels up without laying waste to every relationship around you is certainly a problem.
And then there's the, I presume you share, the sort of inborn Midwestern guiltiness about being famous.
I have sort of selective macular degeneration when it comes to that.
You don't see the groupies chasing you as you go down on Varick Street?
Have not seen that yet, no. I still remain quite pleasantly anonymous. I did have the experience in February after finishing the book. As a reward, I'd promised myself to get my You've Turned 50 colonoscopy, and I was starving, and it was late on a Sunday afternoon. I hadn't eaten since the night before, and I'd spent the day doing some, you know, ingrown weird thing in my office. I don't even remember what, you know, rereading old letters or something like that. And I stumbled out to the supermarket to buy like 4 cartons of sugar-free Jell-O and some diet Mountain Dew. Sugar-free Mountain Dew, and I was in the checkout line, and this incredibly nice couple said, "Sorry, hate to bother you, but are you you?" And I hadn't shaved, and I was just in this kind of miserable, weird, writerly place, and there were 4 cartons of sugar-free Jell-O. Diet Mountain Dew. So I think I fear a certain restriction on my ability to feel completely anonymously like a weirdo. But that's the main fear at this point.
That people will see you as the wimpy, sugar-free, food-eating Midwestern that you are.
You know, that I actually have to worry about the T-shirt I put on when I wander out on a Sunday morning.
The only time in the 500-odd pages of this incredibly densely plotted, information-rich novel that I thought really was at a certain point, the neoconservative Emmanuel Gries, father of the Berglund son's college roommate, announces right after 9/11 at a Thanksgiving dinner that we, the establishment, need to lie about essentially WMDs in Iraq in order to make the invasion go forward. Really? Did you?
I was having some fun with the sort of Straussian notion of the noble lie, and I think it's a little vague whether he's talking about WMD in Iraq. But you know, people have a little wine at a Thanksgiving dinner and let loose and say what's really on their mind
among the tribe and the friends, and
that's right. And you know, that's not there for satiric purposes. That's there for Joey, the son, who's a guest in the house and whose
parents consider him a Republican, even though he's not really.
Not quite. He's probably a libertarian.
All the young people,
and he's just been informed by his college roommate that he's, you know, even by Orthodox standards, he's Jewish, and this had like never occurred to him in 18 years, and so he's just it's part of an experience, and I think taken out of context, you know, well, it's just guesses, right, about what people were really saying and thinking at those dinners that we were not party to.
No, for this, you know, virtually perfect book, my plausibility alarm just went off, started ringing slightly there. You sat down almost a decade ago, to start this book. What did you have when you started? What did you have? What was the plan? How much did you have in terms of characters, plot, happy ending versus not so happy ending?
I didn't really have a clear idea of the story until a year ago. So 10 years ago or whatever, 8-9 years ago, I had fragments of the corrections that had been removed, including a couple of characters and a couple of situations that in my apparently ever-renewable naivete I imagined would make a fine basis for a new novel.
Ever renewable naivete is a key to success, I think.
Yeah, I also seem to have an ever renewable amateurishness when it comes to writing novels. I never feel like those pros I see working. So it's always as if I've never written a novel before. So what did I have? I had some characters who I had to I needed to spend some time with to realize no, they're not going to work in this book either. They need to be retired altogether. And then a few years later, in the course, I was still pursuing one of them, who had previously been the main character of the corrections and was entirely excised. And he, in the course of his work with the Securities and Exchange Commission, solicited an affidavit from a suburban housewife who chose to write about herself in the third person. And for some reason, I think I was under the spell of the Olympic women's soccer team. For some reason, it popped into my head that she'd been an athlete. So I had this little chunk of pages that was the kernel of Patty Berglund, who is at certain points threatens rather obnoxiously to take over the whole book.
And there is this. She does take over the book for a long period of time, and it is this interesting chunk written as her autobiography for her therapist that has written in this kind of arch third person. It is her autobiography, but she refers to herself as the autobiographer. So that was kind of a eureka moment thought?
It stayed with me. You know, I kept generating false starts for years and setting it aside. I published two other books and I did a fair amount
nonfiction
books and a fair amount of journalism. And I kept coming back and piling up more false starts. And the one thing that stayed in the pretty good pile was this fragment of autobiography. And I think she needs to write in third person partly because she's a jock, and jocks talk about themselves in the third person more comfortably because it's been so drummed into them. You suppress the ego for the team.
Emerson, get out there.
Right. And then afterwards, and you know, somebody sticks a mic in your face, and you talk about, well, you know, Jesse Emerson is not going to let himself be pushed around again the way he was tonight. That's part of it. And also, if she has a saving grace during the first sections of the book, it is that she's hard on herself and can be funny about herself, and it just seemed much funnier to do it in third person.
Absolutely, it's also to me the great payoff is that it actually the fact of this thing existing becomes then a driver of story as well later in the book. Was that a aha moment?
No, I'd had that idea for quite some time. She tells all in her autobiography, and it would be. And when it's sort of a gun on the mantelpiece. What if this document were ever to fall into the wrong hands?
I'm so stupid. I never thought that gun had to be fired. But there you go. I was very pleased when it was.
Your own renewable naivete.
Exactly. If you, I know this is the kind of question you hate probably, but if you had to look at your success, and it is large, and attribute a portion to your talent and a portion to your hard work and a portion to luck, how would that break out?
Wow, that's a hard question to answer, period, and an even harder one to answer without sounding like a jerk somehow. But in a sense, it's all luck. There's something that makes sense to me about the Hindu worship, or not worship, but veneration of lucky people. Like, simply by being lucky, there's something cool about that is worthy of our awe. And so, if I were to speak like a jock myself in the third person, you know, I'd say, you know, Jonathan Franzen was lucky to have really great parents, although he didn't think so for a long time. And he was lucky and always knew it to have a couple of great brothers. And you know, good health and born at a prosperous time in the most powerful country on earth, and had some very good luck finding the right agent and editor, and it goes on and on and on. And even the ability to work hard, people say, oh God, it must take so much discipline to write a novel. How can you? I would never have the discipline to do that, and it doesn't even feel like discipline to me. I wouldn't quite go so far as to say, you know, I have a compulsive personality or I'm a workaholic, but it's, you need to do something that is satisfying, if not always happy making, and that's what writing is for me. It doesn't even feel like work. You know, doing these interviews feels like work. And the Protestant guilty part of me takes on the book tour in a spirit of, if you liked what you did, it wouldn't be work. So here I am. But I guess that's a long way of saying I think it's all luck.
Did you have other titles, or was Freedom it from the beginning?
Not from the beginning, but I had to slap a title on the proposal I sold several publishers 3.5 years ago, and I don't even remember where it came from. I think I was in a state of pique about the misuse and the misappropriation of the word freedom in the political sphere in the middle of the last decade, and in a kind of defiant spirit, just slapped it on the proposal, and then could not bear to speak the title aloud to anyone until I was finished with the book. It was something to write toward, and now I can actually say it. The book is called Freedom. In a funny way, the word that I was trying to rescue the word, and now it's become so worn out by my own use of it that it has been defused again.
Well, and I find lots of people are, in fact, weirdly, are not referring to it exclusively by its title, Freedom, but that Franzen book.
Right. Well, exactly. It is sort of...
And Franzen, Freedom, they're similar words.
They are similar words, and it's a pompous word, especially if you don't hear all of the irony in which it's meant to be bathed. So, yeah, call it the Franzen novel.
Call it
the novel with the blue bird on the cover.
If you were all about being a shrewd marketer, it seems like publishing a book, a novel, a great big novel only every 9 years is really working for you. Do you feel like the next one will be sooner or most of another decade?
My ever-renewable naivete leads me to think that I'm now free to write any kind of book I want, and that it could happen as soon as next year. So with all of, I don't know. I don't, there's so little time to read. I don't want to claim the reader's attention until I have something new to say. And I at least don't come up with new things to say every 18 months, at least not say in the way that a novel says things, which is some sort of self-discovery.
Jonathan Franzen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and now we have, this being the 21st century, questions from our listeners who wrote into our Facebook page. I would only ask two of the many, many that we were asked. A guy named Bob Reaney asks, ask Franzen about the Harper's essay from 1996 and how, after the success of the corrections and the release of Freedom, he might update or rewrite that essay today. Does he despair over the current state of the American social novel?
In a sense, I feel like I addressed that by saying that I came up with a communitarian model for reading and writing in that Harper's essay, and at least in the dynamic in my own mind, that is unchanged. That's still the relationship I posit and I'm looking for. The surprise turns out to be that, you know, the audience is the hunger, the desire for a certain kind of book that is not all sunshine and light and doesn't have, you know, completely happy endings and has a certain amount of complexity to its structure and tone. That turns out to be much larger than I would have guessed in the dark mid-90s, and certainly larger than the estimates of the size of the reading audience that Philip Roth is always delivering himself of.
Another question from Kevin Ryan. He says, I'm curious about his reaction to Jodi Picoult's discussion of the bias in literature toward male writers and male fiction, whatever that means, and the tendency of critics to rave about the same core male writers over and over, ignoring the rest.
I haven't read any of those criticisms of that.
She was complaining about all the attention you were getting.
I've heard about them, but I haven't actually seen what she said, so I'm reluctant to comment
directly.
Well,
they're tweets, so they're easy to read.
I will be the last person in the country to receive a tweet. I don't know what she says about me personally, but my feeling is that to point toward a gender imbalance in what is considered serious work and what is considered part of the canon is appropriate. And it's something I'm committed to doing myself, trying to boost the reputations, particularly of women who are no longer producing, but whose the work is there, and why are we focused on such a predominantly male core canon? Let's open it up. My God, it's 2010. So
I feel like I am talking to Walter Berglund now.
Yeah. Well. I think Walter's a little bit more dewy-eyedly feminist than I, but it's hard to disagree, really.
Somebody named Rhea Borgia asks, finally, besides nixing internet access on your computer, how else do you block out distractions while you're writing?
When I was actually writing the book, I got on a very early schedule. Getting up at 6 and being at the office by 7:30, and that necessitated going to bed by 10, and I don't want to just come straight home from something and go to bed, so people would say, do you want to get together? And I'd say, sure, but I have to be home by 9, which in New York means you have no social life. So I was able by promising get-togethers as soon as the book was done to shut down a lot of social encounters too, and that was probably the other main thing. I don't watch TV, except I just watch DVDs. It takes the tiniest trickle through the keyhole to fill a room with sound, and that's the way I feel about the data streaming in and about all the cultural references streaming in. You really don't need that at full volume to get the gist. Not even her own husband.
That's Jonathan Franzen reading from his new novel, Freedom. If Patty had had a serious career, would it all have worked out differently for her, better?
She thinks maybe it would have. Without a career, she becomes, one could say, overly focused on her children, particularly her son. And that's one of the things at the center of the book that I was trying to access from my own life and had found no direct way to write about. And one of the reasons it took so long to write this book was I had to develop this entire parallel world into which to pour my own experience, because I couldn't write about what was really going on with me in the 60s and 70s. It was just couldn't go there.
Is your mother still alive?
My mom's not. She's still alive in some way. She's alive in me. I feel strains in my own character that correspond identically to strains in hers. And so there are times when I feel my mom is saying something and not I.
As you say, you write a lot about these relationships between parents and children, and especially Patty Berglund and her son. You don't have children.
I do not have children.
Was that a challenge consciously of accessing that kind of unconditionalism that presumably you haven't experienced?
It was not the big challenge, certainly. I think the intense, almost morbid sense of identification I have with my own parents, particularly since they died, and the late dawning realization of what great parents they were, that was probably my primary conduit to the experience of having children. It was through my own parents, oddly.
There was a piece in the New York Times last year saying all significant fiction writers of your generation, including you, are too ambivalent about depicting lusty sex. Seems to me, among other things, this book is an answer to that charge in your case.
I remember that piece. I didn't read it, but there was a bar chart on the cover of the Times Book Review, and I was very happy to find myself in the middle. You know, more sex than writers a little younger than me, not as hyper.
But no Roth or Mailer.
Right, exactly. Not quite the same.
But there's plenty of sex in this. There's a lot of hotness in this book.
It's, you know, there's a lot of sex in dreams, and you put yourself into that dream state to do the writing, and sex comes along. It's really as simple as that.
Now, what about birds? I know you've written about environmental catastrophes around the world, and I know you are a bird hobbyist. But in this book, Walter's involvement with saving a bird, to me, is depicted as a somewhat ridiculously quixotic exercise. Did you mean it to be that?
Let me say right here that there's a bird on the cover of the American version. Someone made my day the other day by saying they hadn't noticed the bird because it's in such extreme close-up. But I resisted having that bird there because I thought, oh, my God, that's going to send the message environmental novel. And the last thing I feel like reading is a straightforward environmental novel because it's the news is bad. Great. Can't wait to read it. And we know what's right and we know what's wrong. Well, that sounds like a interestingly complex moral landscape.
And do house cats really kill a million songbirds a day, as you say in this book?
Minimum.
Really?
Minimum.
I felt bad about my cats, my two cats.
Cats should be indoors.
So Walter says, and I guess Jonathan Franzen says as well.
Yes, there are some substantial areas of overlap, particularly on the subject of keeping cats indoors.
Now, if you had to look at your success, and it is large, and attribute a portion to your talent and a portion to your hard work and a portion to luck, how would that break out?
Wow, that's a hard question to answer, period, and an even harder one to answer without sounding like a jerk somehow. But if I were to speak in the third person, you know, I'd say, you know, Jonathan Franzen was lucky to have really great parents, although he didn't think so for a long time. And he was lucky and always knew it to have a couple of great brothers and, you know, good health and born at a prosperous time in the most powerful country on earth. And had some very good luck finding the right agent and editor, and it goes on and on and on. And even the ability to work hard, to do something that is satisfying, if not always happy-making, and that's what writing is for me, it doesn't even feel like work. I guess that's a long way of saying I think it's all luck.
Did you have other titles, or was freedom it from the beginning?
Not from the beginning, but I had to slap a title on the proposal I sold several publishers 3.5 years ago. And I was in a state of pique about the misuse and the misappropriation of the word freedom in the political sphere in the middle of the last decade. And in a kind of defiant spirit, just slapped it on the proposal and then could not bear to speak the title aloud to anyone until I was finished with the book. It was something to write toward. And now I can actually say it. The book is called Freedom. And it's a pompous word, especially if you don't hear all of the irony in which it's meant to be bathed.
If you were all about being a shrewd marketer, it seems like publishing a book, a great big novel, only every 9 years is really working for you. Do you feel like the next one will be sooner or most of another decade?
I don't know. I don't. There's so little time to read. I don't want to claim the reader's attention until I have something new to say. And I at least don't come up with new things to say every 18 months.
Jonathan Franzen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom, is out right now.